Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com. Joining me this week is a writer I've been waiting to talk to about her work since I met her last August in London. Aliette de Borard is the writer of the Obsidian and Blood trilogy of Aztec noir fantasy novels and the Hugo, Nebula and Locus Awards nominated On a Red Station Drifting, as well as multiple short stories. Her newest novel is The Fabulous House of Shattered Wings. It's out soon. It's a story set in a broken Paris, a story of fallen angels and magic and mystery and the devil himself. Aliette, welcome to Midnight in Karachi. You're finally here. Yay!
Hey!
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm enjoying the holiday. I'm enjoying the sun. I'm enjoying the swimming pool. It's great.
And yet you're here talking to me. You're always working.
Yep. And writing a book.
Let's put that in just in case the editors are listening.
Exactly.
So since I've never interviewed you before, I wanted to start with the basics. Tell me about your first professional sale as a writer. What was it and how did it come to be?
I think my first professional sale as a writer was to Interzone. It was back at the time when Jetse de Vries was doing... Interzone only took male submissions and Jetse de Vries did a short email reading period. And, you know, at the time, I live in France, so having to wrangle international reply coupons and everything to Britain was a little bit, time-consuming. So I never bothered to submit to Interzone. But when I saw that they were opening an email submission window, I thought, oh, what the hell? Why not? And then about a month later, I get this email that says in big letters in the subject line, just so I know that this is what's happening, acceptance. And I was like, okay, I'm going to put down this computer right now and I'm going to go somewhere and I'm going to shout very loudly. And it was a short story named Deer Flight, which was a sort of really dark reimagining of Selkie stories, except it was about deer people.
And from there on, were you writing more regularly and submitting more regularly then?
Yeah, I made a concerted effort. I didn't actually get to writing and submitting more regularly until I'd actually almost finished university. And then I started, I focused on short stories because I wrote a couple of like really long, really sprawling, yeah, not really good epic fantasy novels that are about 200,000 word each and that are stuck somewhere in a drawer. And then I thought, you know, nobody is really enthusiastic about reading the novels, so maybe what I'll do is I'll write some short fiction to try and get a hang of this thing called plot and this thing called characters and so on. Obviously, you know, now that I look back on it, I think, yeah, obviously there's quite a different skill set involved in writing a novel and writing a short story, so that may not have been... a good idea for novel writing, but it turned out okay. So I did have to relearn novel writing a few years later. So all in all, it worked.
So did you learn how to write from reading and just from writing fiction itself?
I read a lot. I went to a couple of classes. I attended the Orson Scott Card's writing boot camp when I was in my last year of university. And then I won Writers of the Future, and they flew me down so I could attend some of their courses. And then I hung around a lot on online writing forums. Like online, I spent like about 5 or 6 years of my life on online writing workshops, which is this really, really great venue for like... one of the things that I really like about Critique is like getting a small number of them, because otherwise I just drown. Trying to like take them all in, and online writing workshop was good for getting like 5 or 6 like very focused critiques. I tried critters beforehand, but you would get like 20 critiques and I would just like go crazy trying to sort them out. And then, you know, when you get 20 people commenting on the same thing, they all are gonna have like different ideas of where this is supposed to go. And I was like, okay, like if I were a better writer, maybe I could cope. But as it is, I'm like just like trying to write by consensus. So it's just not working for me. I don't have enough confidence yet to see what I should and shouldn't do.
Right. So now your academic background is in mathematics and engineering, if I recall. But did you always write fiction as well? And how do the two affect each other if they do?
Well, mostly I was always reading a lot. I read a lot of fantasy, a lot of science fiction, even as a kid. And then I moved to London and I sort of discovered that this was this wonderful set of shelves that has science fiction and fantasy written on it, and I could like dip in them and be pretty reasonably sure I'd get what I want, because my old library that was in Paris had this habit of like putting everything together. So you would get a random book, and French books are really, used to be at least, now they're doing slightly better, but like they would have those totally nondescript covers and this kind of like really, really sort of non-informative summary. So you wouldn't actually know what you got until you actually opened the book, and then you would go, hey, this isn't what I ordered. This is some kind of like 19th century romance novel, and I didn't want that currently. So when I moved to the UK, I discovered that there was actually a classification by genre, which, well, I have issues with that, but I can certainly understand the fact that sifting through a lot of books is like exhausting. And I didn't actually start writing fiction until I moved to London. I found this book about writing science fiction and fantasy, and then it sort of occurred to me that writers were not necessarily dead and male, which was what my French curriculum had psychologically prepared me for. And I wrote half a novel. We lost it in the move, which has two positive sides. One, no one will ever see it because it's like truly crashed. And second, I learned very early on about the importance of backups.
Having said that, just you wait now. 5 years from now, someone's going to find that. What is it? Was it a floppy disk?
Yeah.
Yeah, what if someone finds that and manages to recover stuff off it? Oh, that bad, is it?
I was 16!
Yeah, okay, no. Hopefully that will never, ever happen. And if someone finds it, it's covered in fungus and, you know, there's no recovery and all the rest of it.
Yeah, otherwise I'll lend them a handy magnet.
But that's interesting what you said about the covers, because, you know, it reminds me of my school here in Karachi when I was younger. They used to do this thing in order to make the books last longer, the paperbacks. They would slice off the back and the front and they would hard bind them. And so you would have like, you'd have the name sort of typed or written in hand on this hard bound book that was actually a paperback, but you didn't have the cover and it didn't have the back blurb. So the only way you could take it out of the library, I mean, if you wanted to know what was going on, you'd take it off the shelf and you'd kind of read the first couple of pages and guess out what was going on based on the title. This is, of course, pre-internet, so no one was Googling what it was about. So I see what you mean with that.
Yeah, I sympathize. The French edition of, I think it was, it's either Lord Valentine's Castle by Robert Silverberg or its follow-up. It's got a really pretty silver spiral and it says a novel underneath. And then you flip it over and there's three lines. I can't remember what they are, but they are totally non-informative about even the fact that this is an SF book. And I was like, okay, well, let me try that. I mean, I don't regret trying it, but obviously there have been a couple surprises along the way.
I'm sure. Now tell me about your background in mathematics and with computers and stuff. Does that play into what you're doing with your writing, or does it just make you sort of really organized?
It does make me really organized. I mean, I have an engineer's approach to writing, which is I tend to go for like, okay, this is the outline. We're going to do this according to the outline. And if the outline doesn't work, we'll then rewrite the outline so I have an idea of what is going on. I mean, I know some people pants it. I just can't improvise. I'm like, I feel like I need some kind of this is where we're going structure. Even if the somewhere we're going can be quite vague. I mean, the first Obsidian and Blood synopsis that I wrote for the first book, the last three chapters were covered by somehow they win the day. So so what I studied mainly was mathematics and computer science. So in my day job, I used to be a programmer. Now I tell programmers what to do. I do system design. It means, I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, it means that I sort of can like fake my way through a science fiction story, like by giving just enough details about the science that makes me sound authoritative on what I'm saying. And on the other hand, I have trouble writing a certain kind of science fiction, the one that deals with what happens in like 50 years time, because one of the things that I do for my day job is like imagine the systems of say 2 to 5 years time. So doing like the same thing for science fiction story sort of reminds me a little too much of my future, of my day job. I can do it. It's interesting. And I suspect it's one of the reasons why most of my novels have actually turned out to be fantasy, because I feel like I need a break.
So tell me, in all this, where does the interest in the Aztec come from?
I took Spanish classes, actually. And in Spanish classes, we covered history of Mexico. And one of the things they always said about Aztecs and history of Mexico was, you know, because it was the conquistadors' point of view, that it was a really bloodthirsty culture that got what was coming to it. And I was like, you know, I'm really, really doubtful of this. This doesn't strike me as, you know, accurate. It strikes me as having been written by people who were justifying themselves. So I sort of I started reading a bit and researching a bit, and that's how I ended up writing Obsidian and Blood, as a sort of, let's show what this culture was like at the height of its glory.
On a Red Station Drifting was created, I believe, as a sort of remake of a Chinese classic novel called Dreams of Red Mansions.
Mm-hmm.
What was it about the Chinese novel that made you want to write On a Red Station Drifting?
Well, the Chinese novel Dream of Red Mansions is it's like one of the four classics of Chinese literature. It's like this very, very thick book, and it chronicles the history of a big, big household in decline, in a slow kind of sort of slowly dying out, a decline through lack of funds, lack of family fortunes, and so on. And one of the things that I think it did extremely well, especially considering the fact that it's, I think, an 18th or 19th century novel of ancient China, which was could be a fairly misogynistic society, is this is a book that is solely focused on women. There's 12 main women characters that all embody some kind of aspect of womanhood. So you've got the fragile, delicate one, you've got the ruthless one who's like completely running the household and its finances. And I wanted to do some of what it was doing in an SF setting, that is to have like two very different women trying to do two very different things, except it turns out they both kind of want the same thing, but they would be at cross purposes for most of the novel. And I also wanted to set it in this sort of like space station that had seen better days kind of atmosphere. And because I wasn't like, I wanted to do the Vietnamese version of this rather than the Chinese one, because I was more familiar with the Vietnamese, even though I did keep a lot of the Chinese elements.
Now, that leads us quite neatly into the next question. Now, all these various cultural influences that are in your life, that are your life, that make you you, they also work their way, obviously, into your books, into your fiction. In a way, it seems to me that you have multiple aspects of this, or from this mix to choose from, this mix that obviously is completely unique, ultimately, to you, to your experience of, say, French culture or English or Vietnamese or even Chinese, as you just mentioned. Are you swayed in a certain cultural direction based on what interests you in that culture at that point? Or is it the premise of the story that you're working on that leads you to those influences?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I really don't know. I mean, one of the things for me that's very important when I'm writing is like, I need to know what kind of like background the story takes place against. Like, I need to know, like, different cultures have different focuses. So, for instance, like, for the Aztecs of the 15th century, being a warrior was, like, this very important and this key thing that was the ideal of mainstream Aztec society. Whereas if, for instance, you take Vietnamese culture of around the same time period, the ideal was not the warrior, the ideal was the learned scholar, and like warriors were looked down on because they were people who had failed at being scholars. And I think, I mean, this isn't to say that like every single character that you introduce in those societies have to be warriors or have to be scholars, but for me it helps a lot to know what kind of expectations they're laboring against, how the rest of society views them, what kind of, you know, social class structure they're moving against, that sort of thing. Right. And for me, that's a big part of like actually putting a story together, which means that mainly I get stuck with a lot of prep work just to write 3 lines on paper, but I can deal. One of the things that I very frequently do for novels is like I have those character sheets of like what the characters wants most and what the character hates most and loves most and fears most. and it's a sort of very handy snapshot, and I sort of like try to do these against the background of like the society that they're moving in. So for instance, in the Obsidian and Blood trilogy, the main character Akal wanted to be a priest, and against the society that he was moving in, which was mainly warriors, that would mark him as a failure because his father was a peasant and really wanted his sons to rise in Aztec society, and that meant warriors.
That sounds a lot like, you know, making or creating computer systems. You have one small aspect on the screen and lines and lines and lines of code behind it.
Yeah, or the iceberg.
Or the iceberg. Same difference, really. Now, I'm beginning to think of a great deal of recent science fiction as post-colonial science fiction. I'm not sure that I've completely defined this in my head as something specific, if I've even got my own sort of rules for this. But there are a great deal of stories and novels coming out from writers who are not from the sort of white Western background, you know, to put it loosely. And it all seems to me to be post-colonial. Almost feels like a way of sort of taking back power in a way. How do you see this change in science fiction writing?
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I've been... I mean, it's really tricky because on the one hand, I think it's very, very easy to, and I've seen it happen, to rewrite the history of the genre so that you completely ignore like people who don't seem to fit your idea of it. So like, I don't know about like non-Western writers, but for instance, with women, you see it very clearly because when people make a history of, say, epic fantasy in the 80s or 90s, they always forget, they're like citing the same three or four guys.
Right.
And like 99% of the time they're guys, and then the women who were working at the same time and who were equally influential get left out. So I think it's like very easy to have a perception of history that says, you know, it used to be all white, which is the same thing you have with, for instance, like, you know, there used to be no people of color in London in the 19th century. That is patently false, but like a lot of people are still stuck on this idea.
Yeah.
So at the same time, it is certainly true that a lot of like non-Western people have become more prominent, you know, getting book deals, making a huge splash, getting nominated for awards, winning awards, and so on and so forth. And there's a lot of books coming out that come from that same source. And I think part of it is, you know, well, the internet has been a great help in that regard. When I started out, it was back in 2006, which isn't so far down the line, but I remember that a lot of it was still made by post, you know? And now most of the magazines don't even take postal submissions anymore, it's all email. And that makes it, you know, the entry bar is lower. I mean, I remember when I was thinking of getting an agent, looking at guidelines, and like, you have to send like this 800 double space manuscript to us in the US, and I took a look at it and I was like, yeah, I can't afford that.
Right.
So I think.
And how many agents could you send that to anyway?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, so there's part of it, and there's part of, you know, shifting. Part of it is also shifting attitudes, which obviously is the frustrating part because that usually takes a lot of time. Well, I mean, more time than people usually have patience for.
Right.
But I'm confident that we're seeing, hopefully it's like the first steps to like a major explosion.
Absolutely. Now let's talk a little bit about language. I'm interested in this because, we were just talking about reading in different languages, French libraries and moving to England and of course Vietnamese as well, the language and the culture and Chinese. What language do you think in and what do you write in and speak in? Like, are they ever all the same thing? Do you ever find yourself mixing them all up? I mean, I do this personally. I find myself speaking the wrong language to the wrong person very often, not realizing the other person can't speak it.
I will usually reach for the most convenient word. That most convenient word can very often not be in the language that the person expects to hear.
Right.
And like my mom does it all the time when she's speaking to her, like to her family in Vietnam, you know, she'll reach for like the French word because it's like convenient, and like at least they understand each other because like some of my family speaks French, and those who don't, like, there's the loan words are actually, there's been a lot of French loan words to Vietnamese, so they can sort of make themselves understood. But sometimes they look at her really funny.
Right.
And sometimes people look at me really funny as well when I go like, I think that's a perfect Vietnamese word for this. I mean, don't get me wrong, my Vietnamese sucks, but sometimes it actually, I actually have the word in the wrong language. I try to think in the same language that I write into, because I found that it's a lot of energy switching between languages. I attended Welcon in Montreal back in 2009, I think it was, and I spent most of it switching between French and English, and by the time the con was over, I was on my knees, because it was an effort to keep like both trains of thought running at the same time.
Right.
I mean, I don't really translate anymore consciously. You know, if you ask me like, what is this word in English, I'm probably going to have to ask you for the context or something so I can visualize it or like get a mental image of it and then get the description in English. And that's, I mean, for me, at least that was, you know, that's what happened when I became bilingual. I sort of cut the umbilical cord between languages. So like, I'm speaking to you right now and all of this is going through English. There's no pause, you know, stepping on the little island in French before I can actually tell you things. But when I'm in a setting where I'm code switching all the time, then I have to like continuously like switch mentally between French English, Vietnamese, whatever is appropriate. And I'm currently in Spain and I'm doing French, English, Spanish, and that was fun.
Yeah. And when you write, of course, and you read, do you read in languages that are not English?
I mostly read in English because it's a bit of a selfish thing. I don't actually speak English in my daily life. I don't speak much English except to my son. So I don't have much of a way of like keeping my command of the language together if it's not through reading and through online activity.
Right.
So if I start reading too much in French, I'm probably going to lose the English because I never get a chance to practice it. I do try to read the occasional book in French, and I've done Spanish, I've done Vietnamese, but they have to be like really, really basic books or recipe blogs.
Right.
I have a highly specialized vocabulary.
Yes. I'm sure you're fine with cookbooks, right?
Yep. Cookbooks and anything involving maternal family.
There we go. All right, let's talk a little bit about the new novel, House of Shattered Wings, which I was praising earlier off air as well. What was the initial premise for this? Let's tell everyone about it.
Well, I actually started as a very different book. Back, I finished the last book of my Obsidian and Blood trilogy, and I met up with my agent in London, and we had this chat over lunch. And I told him, I mean, I want to write a... I don't actually remember what I told him, but anyway, we sort of agreed that I was going to write this urban fantasy set in Paris. And so I turned in the first draft of it. It was taking place in, you know, here and now in Paris. It was dealing with magicians' families fighting each other for influence in Paris. And he got it, and about 3 weeks later, he got back to me and he said, "Can we talk on the phone?" And he was like, "You know, I mean, I've like, you know, shown it around to a few editors and stuff, and it's like competent, but I can tell that your heart is not in it." And so, you know, I moped a bit, obviously, because it's never pleasant to hear. And then I took a look at it and I was like, yeah, he's right. And, you know, I'm not, I think one of the reasons it never really came together for me was that the magical system was a bit vague, and the world building didn't really make me feel excited. So I was like, okay, I need something a little bit more out of left field, and I couldn't figure out what. And I had, at the same time, I had this series of short stories that I also never really gone really far with. They were set in this sort of like atemporal city called Silver Spires, and they had a PI character doing investigations in a city where you had like fallen angels tumbling from the sky and people trafficking in angel bones, because they made a drug from angel bones that people got addicted to. And I shelved them because, again, you know, it was shortly before I hit my stride as a short story writer, and they were, you know, very clearly the before stage. One of them actually stops midway around the 12,000 word plot or something, and I was like, I must have gotten bored with it or something. It's like right at the point a character dies and it stops. mid-sentence. And I was, I visited Rachita Lunenrus, who's a very good friend of mine and who lives in the Netherlands, and we were talking about the novel, and I was bitching and being frustrated, and then I don't know why the short stories came up. And I was like, I read the short stories and I would like to do something with them, but I'm really not sure. And she listened to me talk for a while and she was like, Aliette, you should write the novel. And I was like, what novel? And she was like, you should write this novel. And I was like, okay. And, you know, I thought on it and I thought that she was, as is often the case, entirely right. And that I could, like, take my fallen angels, like, make Silver Spire is not a city but a house, a magical faction, and then for good measure nuked Paris, because I don't know, because there's always been something very appealing to me about, like, dystopia and, like, how people survive in the circumstances. So I moved everything to a past magical war Paris, where you had, instead of magicians' families, you had those magical factions that became houses, and each house was a kind of little fortress that took care of its own and then fought the other for influence. And then I threw in a random Vietnamese character because, hell, at this point, why not? I might as well. And I sent the entire thing to my agent, the first three chapters, and he got back to me and he said, okay, whatever it is that you're doing, please keep doing it. Okay, I'll take that as a vote of confidence.
Right, and you did it so well. I really enjoyed this book.
Okay, thanks.
But tell me a little bit about this sort of the Catholic background to the story, because there is very much that, the idea of the angels basically being kicked out of heaven down to this broken earth, this broken Paris, you know, not knowing why you've been banished from heaven, this guilt, I suppose, of a sin that you can't remember, and then this burden of trying to do right by others when you're on this earth once again. It's all pretty heavy stuff, but you've dealt with it with a really skillful hand, because I greatly enjoy, you know, good plot, as one should. And this has all of that. But tell me a little bit about the sort of religious aspect of this and where that came from.
Well, I think, I mean, it's kind of hard to have fallen angels in the book and kind of not bring up religious aspects. So I knew I was going to have to do it at some point. And one of the things that I really didn't want to deal with was, like, the whole is there a God thing or not. I thought that, you know, after they tumble back to Earth, they should basically be like the rest of us and really have no special line to heaven or nothing that would make them, I guess, theologically superior is the word I would use. So I just wanted them to have the same doubts and crises of faith as ordinary people, except, well, they're fallen angels, so they'd be a bit larger scale. But so that's one of the things I was trying to do. And the other thing that I was trying to do was, like, I wanted to have... I cannot for the life of me remember the books, but I was reading a series of books where, like, every single religion in the world got folded into the same magical system, and that magical system being, like, Christian. And I was like, this makes me really uneasy. this sends out, like, messages, especially considering, you know, the Christian religion's history with other religions, that made me really uncomfortable. So I thought, you know, there's several religions. I'm not going to get into an argument about which one is right or not, because that's not the point of the book. I want to write, like, this fun, fast-paced murder mysteries where people die. So I don't really want to stop for that kind of thing. And so I threw in a different magic system, which is the one that Philippe, the Vietnamese character, comes from, which is based on Taoist myth and legends. So instead of falling down, you ascend from being human. And, I mean, I didn't actually set up the counterpoint to the fallen angels. I sort of, like, did it by itself, because that's generally the myth. I didn't touch anything. But I thought it made for an interesting counter-narration. One of the things that I was trying to do with Philippe was very much to have someone who's not only not privy to the system that I was describing, but who loathes it and who has been a victim of it and who, if given a chance, would bring it down.
And I know there's a sequel, isn't there?
There is, yes.
Do we know anything about the sequel? Can we talk about it? We can't talk about it, can we?
Not much. I mean, the idea at this stage is all very tentative. It's like to focus it on a different great house. So the first one was focused on House Silver Spires, and the second one would be focused on House Hawthorne. But, like, you know, this is all very... I haven't started to plot yet, and I haven't gotten any of this past my editors.
So we won't say anything else about it. But I'm looking forward to it, whenever. Now, I have some questions via Twitter, because of course we do. Rachel asks, what's the most interesting thing you've learned while researching your book?
Well, one of the things, I mean, it's a bit of a cheat, really, because I reused existing research and I wasn't actually specifically doing it for the book. But one of the things that came up in revisions was that there was too much plot. This is a thing I very, you know, do very often, which is like, you know, they were breezing from one catastrophical happening to the next, and there was just no time for the characters to, like, get lives beyond the plot and feel fleshed out. So my US editor, Jess Wade, was, like, very insistent, and she was entirely right, that there should be some bonding between characters. And one of the ways that I did this was that I had them bake bread together in the house's kitchens.
Yeah, it was a wonderful scene.
Yep. And that was me, actually. I self-taught myself baking for a couple of months because I've always been annoyed at being unable to knead dough. So I figured I would start. And so for a couple of months, I was really into, like, cooking bread and that sort of thing. And now I feel like I've mastered it, so I've moved on to something else. But all the baking stuff is, you will get pretty decent bread if you do this.
You know I'm never going to do it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I know. I'm the wrong person. But there'll be people out there who will learn. Angel bread, yes. So Keith asks if you have any thoughts on why stories about angels, fallen or otherwise, are becoming popular as compared to vampires or aliens.
I don't really know. I mean, I think there's a huge paranormal thing because, the allure of the fallen angel is, you know, the seductive aspects of it, of them, which is very much tied to Catholic idea, well, Catholic and other Christian denominations' idea of, like, sin being seductive. One of the things that I did with my Lucifer Morningstar, my Deva, was to make him really powerful and really, really, really alluring to most characters, even those who weren't inherently convinced that he was great. I think in a lot of instances, it's a bit like vampires. You know, the dark stranger that can be redeemed, and you know, what better challenge than actually redeeming a fallen angel? In general, fantasy, I'm like less aware of novels involving fallen angels, so I'm not too sure I could comment.
Bronte asks if you have any recommendations for writers who want to research and write other SF Aztec stories.
Well, it's a big help if you speak Spanish. If you don't, there's a couple of excellent... I mean, there's a sort of council of Nahual people. I wish I had known that existed actually before I started writing the Obsidian Blood novels. That they have a website online. There's Miguel Portilla León, who's a Mexican guy, and he's doing a couple of really great... He did... a couple of translations of stuff from Nahuel, and In the Language of Kings, which is his anthology of Mexican fiction from the Aztecs to the, I think it's the early 20th century or something, which is really great. And then there's mexicolor.co.uk, I think. They're a British website, and they get together a lot of resources about Aztecs.
Glenn goes straight to the point and asks, where is the food bunk story? Even I want to know, Elliot, where is the food bunk story?
I don't know. I wrote a story about tea. Does that count?
I don't know. Will Glenn be satisfied with it? Is it tea bunk? Can we call it that?
Well, it's tea-based hard SF, really. It's like a study around three kinds of tea and the loss of someone in the far future universe, and it was up in Clarksville in the January issue. I'm afraid, as far as food punk goes, the only one I've written is On the Red Station Drifting, which has the wonderful banquet scene.
Yeah. But and, I like this tea-based hard SF. That's a good phrase.
It's my new jam.
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense. It could be your life, tea-based hard SF. All right, so tell me what's next for you. Fine, we're not going to talk about the sequel, but I know you've been working on some short stories. What's going on?
So I've got a bunch of short stories and anthologies. I'm gonna have one in Dave Brint's Chasing Shadows, which is going to be about basically social media of the future and different levels of authentication necessary to access social life, which was a bit of an experiment, so that was fun. And I'm gonna have a novella, The Citadel of Weeping Pearls, which is a sort of very loose sequel to On the Red Station Drifting. It's going to be in the October-November issue of Asimov's, and it's about as long as On the Red Station Drifting, so it's like hefty novella, and it focuses on a it's a retelling of a Vietnamese fairy tale, and it focuses on the disappearance of an imperial princess and like the ripples this has in the lives of the empress and like more ordinary folks as well.
All right, so that's something we've got to look forward to before the next novel.
Yep, yeah, it should be out quite soon actually, because the October November issue is just around the corner with Asimov's lead time on actually publishing things.
Right, excellent. Well, have a good time in London. I believe, do you want to tell people where you're going to be? I believe you're going to be all over the place promoting the new book.
Yeah, on the 5th of August, I'll be at Blackwell's in High Holborn from roughly 6:30 to 9, and I'll be in conversation with Anna Caltabiano, who will be promoting her book, The Time of the Clockmaker, which is a sequel to The Seventh Myth, Miss Hatfield. And I will be on the following day, so the 6th of August, Thursday, I think it's the 6th, at Fantasy in the Court at Goldsboro Books. And I have been told that there will be copies of House of Shattered Wings handy. And oh, and I'm going to be at Worldcon. So that's definitely going to be doing a reading and a signing and a couple other panels while I'm at Worldcon. So that's definitely still in the future.
All right, well, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak to me today.
Okay, thank you. That was fun.